to Resettled Radio, brought to you by the ARCC, live on Planet FM.
Stay tuned for current affairs, conversation, interviews, music and more,
as we explore the perspectives and stories from resettled communities.
And bring you information from within the resettlement sector.
I am from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Democratic Republic of Congo is a French-speaking nation, so I did all of my education in French. Not many Congolese people speak English. My family is a big African family. I have my mum and dad, four brothers and two sisters. I am the youngest. My family lived in a village called Goma, the eastern region of Democratic Republic of Congo, where I was born and raised and where I spent most of my life. My life in Goma had been good until foreign forces came and took control over my country. The foreign forces used their organized militias to lynch innocent people. After the president and military dictator of Democratic Republic of Congo, at the time my country was called Zaire, Mobutu Sese Seko, was overthrown in 1996, the instability in Democratic Republic of Congo became worse because of mass murders. Even ordinary families were targeted, but no one was ever held accountable for the crimes committed. At that time, my older brother worked at a human rights agency in Kinshasa, the capital city of Democratic Republic of Congo. His job mostly involved recording and reporting atrocities committed by various armed groups. Because of my older brother's work as a human rights activist, unknown people sent us hate messages numerous times and threatened our lives. Later, they launched a massive hunt to kill my older brother, so he had to go into hiding and I accompanied him. They were so determined to kill my older brother and the rest of our family. One day, our family heard that some armed men came to our village and killed three of our family's friends for failing to locate us. The armed men took the bodies into the bush, chopped them into parts, and displayed the cut-off parts in our village. The killers did so as a way of sending a message to us that no one in our family would be spared. The unfortunate killing of our family's friends was shocking. We felt frightened. The scariest part was that we didn't even know who these armed men were. They could be anyone. They could even have been state-sponsored organized groups. We had no idea. Knowing that our family was in imminent danger, my older brother talked to the Red Cross, requesting that our family should be smuggled out through the border to Uganda. The Red Cross knew about the threat to our family, so we were all crammed into a car marked as the Red Cross and secretly driven to the Uganda border. Fortunately, we managed to escape safely. From the Ugandan border, we started to look for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Uganda. In a United Nations High Commissioner office, we were able to register ourselves as refugees under protection. The officer asked us to stay in a refugee camp in Uganda. However, my older brother resisted the idea of our family staying at a refugee camp. He demanded that we should live in Kampala, the capital city of Uganda. This was because the refugee camp was so poorly protected and we could easily be killed. I also felt that those who wanted to exterminate us in Democratic Republic of Congo might still be pursuing us on Ugandan soil. In the end, our family was able to move to Kampala and stay there. Sadly, my older brother's wife died soon after in Kampala due to what the post-mortem report described as poisoning. I also got scared. I felt that from that moment on, any one of us could die at any time. Not long after the tragic death of my brother's wife, one of his twin sons also passed away by poisoning. It was a double tragedy for our family. Later, we found out that those killers had indeed pursued us all the way from Democratic Republic of Congo to Uganda. This made me think that the enemy might have already been at the refugee camp, mingling with us unknowingly, and that they could see us, but we could not see them. Our family felt so anxious that we had to request to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to arrange settlement to another country under a protection case. The United States, Canada, and Australia were on our top three choices. United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was fully convinced that our lives were indeed in danger. In the beginning of 2002, we lodged our application for resettlement, and we waited until any country accepted our application. While waiting in the refugee camp in Kampala, my cousin and I opened a tailoring shop. The little income that we received from the tailoring business supplemented the meager assistance that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees had provided us. Canada was the first country that responded to our application. Unfortunately, it declined our request for resettlement, but they did not provide any reason. We later learned from our friends that Canada accepted only refugees with small-sized families and people who speak proper English for resettlement. Our family consisted of 15 members. It's a small village. Also, no one in our family spoke good English. We had lived in Kampala for 7 years as refugees. At that time, I was still single, but my older brother remarried. Despite the help from the rest of us, it was still hard for him to take care of all his young children. In the beginning of 2009, New Zealand responded to our case, and we heard that our application was finally successful. At the end of 2009, our family arrived in New Zealand. Life in New Zealand was different to Democratic Republic of Congo. First of all, I couldn't speak English at all, because I had never gone to any English school. All I knew in English was the word good. So when people asked me, how are you? I answered, good. When people asked me, where are you going? I replied, good. When people asked me, how long have you been here? I said, good. Sometimes I even responded in French. In the first 6 weeks in New Zealand, we stayed at Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre. And then all 15 of us were taken from Auckland to Hamilton for resettlement. Once we arrived in Hamilton, volunteers from the Refugee and Migrant Services offered us a lot of support. For the first 6 months, they helped us with opening bank accounts, shopping, paying bills, and managing our lives in this new home, city, and country. The Congolese and Sudanese communities in Auckland also gave us a lot of support for our resettlement in Hamilton. The hardest thing as a newcomer in Hamilton was to find a job. It was very difficult to get one. Most employers asked me if I had any work experience in New Zealand. I couldn't understand why I needed work experience in New Zealand for a job that anyone was capable of. Having a prerequisite for work experiences in New Zealand would have been a great challenge for any immigrants from refugee backgrounds who had just arrived. Initially, I came to New Zealand with a mindset that I would not depend on social welfare. I was determined to start working straight away. But with the New Zealand employment system, I had to. I think many immigrants would have caught up with things quickly if they were given chances to be trained for jobs. Some immigrants would come to New Zealand with big dreams, but those dreams could not progress without securing a job. I was able to get a full-time cleaning job for night shift while I was studying a 2-year English course at the Waikato Institute of Technology in Hamilton. A good friend of mine at school introduced me to someone who knew a cleaning company, and I applied for a cleaning job. I learned that networking was very important to find a job in New Zealand. As an immigrant, it was even difficult to get a cleaning job. It's hard to get a job without knowing anyone. I started going to work at night while going to school during the day. After completing the English course, my English had improved a lot. I enrolled for a certificate in social practice, and I completed it in 2013. Some employers entertain racial profiling at the workplace, despite it being against the law. At my cleaning job, I was called many racial names. Although they all knew my last name, Butu, which was easy to pronounce for anyone, my colleagues would say things like, "Hey, Blackie, bring this and that." I was upset. The more disturbing thing was that even when I raised the issue of racial discrimination to my supervisor, he never acted. When I approached my manager, he didn't take any action either. In the end, I quit my job because racism affected me mentally at work. My Indian workmate in the same company went through the same racial discrimination, and he also quit his job. With this experience of racial discrimination, I didn't know who to turn to for help, especially after my manager didn't do anything to stop what was going on. I felt like I didn't belong. A word of advice to new immigrants and those who are coming to settle in New Zealand is that it is a completely different environment here. Be prepared for culture shock. You may not find a job as quickly as you wish upon your arrival, or your boss might be lenient with racial discrimination in the workplace. Weather and social life are also different. Life in New Zealand is good. People are friendly, kids go to school for free, and healthcare is awesome. But it's so stressful if you don't have family members who will be on your side for moral support. In New Zealand, you can say anything or do anything you wish as long as you don't cross the line. Freedom of speech or freedom to associate with anyone is pretty much provided to anybody in New Zealand. But some people quickly abuse these freedoms. Many young immigrants quickly forget that it was a lack of such freedoms that forced them out of their respective countries in the first place. I came to New Zealand to rebuild my life. I am currently a second-year student studying for a Bachelor of Social Work in Auckland while working part-time. My dream is to work with people and help them. New Zealand is my home, and I have to contribute to building it.
I think that we do have to be measured. I do think we have to be prepared to put in good resource to ensure that the resettlement is a positive experience, both for those people coming here and for the people living in New Zealand already.
I am from Ethiopia. I spent the years of my youth liberating my people in Ethiopia. I joined the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a mass rebellion movement established to overthrow the communist dictator, Colonel Mengistu Haile Mariam. Initially, Haile Mariam came into power in 1978 after overthrowing the emperor, Haile Selassie, in a bloody coup. After the coup, this communist dictator ruled Ethiopia with an iron fist. He used an autocratic military mechanism that he called Derg and the rest of the world called Red Terror. He committed genocide throughout his tenure in office. He also relied on the Soviet Union for economic plans, which yielded no favorable results. Eventually, Ethiopia was hit by terrible famine. As a result of his dictatorship, Tigray People's Liberation Front and other armed forces of Ethiopia formed an alliance. In May 1991, we were able to overthrow the communist dictator. After removal of the Derg or Red Terror regime, all of the armed forces, including Tigray People's Liberation Front, merged and formed a transitional government under the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front in an effort to restore democracy and the rule of law. I was honored to serve in the transitional government under Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi Aris. I was a big man, holding an influential position in Ethiopia, but I was not happy with the government that I served. This was because there were a lot of abuses of the rights we had fought for as a nation. There was no space to speak up. Although the new Prime Minister had made a lot of economic recovery within a short period of time, he failed to deliver democracy. He used to talk about fighting for democracy and civil rights, but there was only lip service. Eventually, my unhappiness with the new regime was noticed by the intelligent apparatus, and my basic rights were breached. In 1993, I decided to flee Ethiopia. Bearing in mind that the Ethiopian government was looking for me, I asked one of my relatives to accompany me to Eritrea to avoid suspicion along the way. We both dressed up and acted like farmers and set out to the northern region of Ethiopia. We walked for 4 horrible days to reach the nearest town in Eritrea. When we arrived, I went straight to the Dikembe military base, the largest military base in Eritrea, because I didn't know anybody. I was hoping that I could get a temporary permit that would allow me to stay legally in Eritrea. Luckily, I was able to obtain the temporary permit that I needed. I had to spend days without food because I didn't have any money to buy food. I had a gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch that I could sell, but nobody could buy them. This was because the trade law in Eritrea required that I must have a receipt for anything that I wanted to sell. Unfortunately, I had no receipt. People might have thought that I'd stolen them, so nobody wanted to buy my items. In the end, I became a hungry man in the streets of Asmara, capital city of Eritrea. I also didn't have a place to sleep. I searched for a place to spend a night, but I couldn't find one. So I went to the nearest police station to spend the night in jail. The police officer in the night duty asked me, "What do you want?" "I want to spend a night in jail," I told him. Why? Have you killed anybody? The police officer asked. No, I haven't committed any crime, sir. I'm new in town and I don't know anybody. I'm flat broke. I just want to spend the night here. I'll leave tomorrow morning, I replied. He noticed that I was very weak, so he opened the door for me. You'll sleep in a woman's cell. There are no female prisoners today, he replied, and directed me to the cell. I consented to the police officer and followed his directions. I slept on the bare, cold floor without a bed or blanket. It was an awful night. No one offered me a place to spend the night except the prison. This is an interesting world, I said to myself as I fell asleep. In the morning, I woke up and thanked the police officer for his kindness, and then I disappeared into the streets. As soon as I stepped out of the prison, I met a shoe shiner. I have gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch with me, and I want to sell them cheap. Would you be interested, I asked. Oh, good, I want your watch. How much are you selling for? It looks expensive, the shoe shiner replied. 120 Ethiopian birr, but I don't have the receipts. Never mind about the receipts, the shoe shiner replied, and agreed to buy the flashy citizen watch. I'll give you 20 birr as a tip, I replied, after receiving the 100 birr from him. My life in Asmara was not good. I didn't feel well, and I even had a suicide plan. Eventually, I decided to look for help. I used the 80 birr out of my 100 birr to make a phone call to one of my relatives in Saudi Arabia, asking for immediate financial help. My relative immediately reacted to my situation and sent me 1,000 birr within a few minutes. I was overexcited. I felt like a millionaire. Happiness was written all over my face. My mission was to get out of Africa. By any means, I wanted to get out of Eritrea because I felt insecure. If Ethiopian authorities had ever found me, I would have been arrested or killed. I had to act quickly. I approached several embassies in Asmara to get a visa out of Eritrea. However, all of the embassies I contacted declined to provide me with a visa. It was only the Italian embassy that was willing to issue me a visa, but they wanted to charge me $3,000, and there's no way that I could possibly afford it. So my search for a visa failed terribly. I even went to the American consulate to seek help, but the rude American senior employee didn't want to talk to me. He also looked down on me. I asked him, "Can you help me find where to go to be helped as a refugee?" "Okay, this guy will take you to the place that deals with people like you. Just follow him," he replied, and instructed one of his guys on what to do. There I met Peter Cook, the general manager of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. I presented my case to him, a political refugee case. He listened to me and said, "I will first check your details in Ethiopia to make sure that you indeed ran away for political reasons." He took my details, including my job title, work address, home phone number and address. He wanted to verify whether I could be granted as a political asylum under United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Eritrea. A few days later, I was called to Peter Cook's office to be briefed about the facts he had found about me in Ethiopia. He said, "I agree with you that you have indeed escaped Ethiopia for political reasons, so I consent to provide you the protection you need." As of the 1st of January 1994, I became the first refugee in Eritrea. I was granted political asylum under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees with available and valid reasons. At that time, Eritrea was the newest nation, and a United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees branch had just been established there. Peter Cook offered me a job, but I turned his offer down because I wasn't interested in working. I just wanted to get out of the vicinity of Ethiopia. It would take no time and energy for Ethiopian intelligence officers to find me in Eritrea. One time, two Ethiopian security operatives even tried to kidnap me in Eritrea's Port Massawa, and I was only able to survive with the help of my cousin. The people at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees knew my life was at risk, so I was told to go to Sudan in a manner that resembled deportation. I had no choice but to accept to go to Khartoum, Sudan, for my own safety. This was after I'd been living in Eritrea for a year and a half. This had been a difficult time, for I was also dealing with the loss of my son, who had died back in Ethiopia. Life in Khartoum was a bit better than Eritrea. I got a job with an Irish non-governmental organization in Khartoum to support myself. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees told me that my case was preferred for Australia. Several months had passed without hearing from Australia. After a long waiting period, I finally heard from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. It's so unfortunate that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Sudan was so corrupted. You have to bribe the key United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees employees to get your file processed, said the officer. In 1997, I was offered a chance to resettle in Canada with three other political asylum colleagues. I satisfied all of their requirements. I met all the costs, including the medical checkup. I paid 600,000 Sudanese dollars, roughly equivalent to US $1,000. I was medically fit and everything was good. This application looked promising in every single way, but for unknown reasons, the case died. By that time, I felt like all of my doors were closed. I had heard that political refugee cases were processed urgently and that political asylum seekers usually got cleared for resettlement within a month by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. However, I spent 6 months staying in Sudan, and while waiting, I lost hope. Then unexpectedly, good luck knocked at my door. An interview with a woman for a chance to resettle in New Zealand. I was blown away with this great news. I didn't expect anything at this point in time. I got ready for the interview. This Kiwi woman who interviewed me was super polite. She felt sorry for me after hearing my story. Political asylum seekers do not have to wait 6 months without being given a chance to resettle. This category is always urgent, said the Kiwi woman. I finished the interview and she told me, "You will be resettling in New Zealand." I was super excited. I spent most of that afternoon reading about New Zealand online because I'd never heard of this tiny, peaceful nation. The resettlement process was also expedited. I came to New Zealand in 2000. I stayed in the Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre upon arrival. After 6 weeks, it was time to move into the communities. I wanted to live in Auckland, so I talked to Housing New Zealand. However, my request was declined because I was destined for Wellington. Regardless of the decision on the resettlement location, I didn't really like how the employees of Housing New Zealand treated me in processing my case. They were so rude, but I brushed off their rudeness. Luckily, two Kiwi friends took me to their house to stay with them. This was my first taste of kindness in New Zealand. I liked the country already. I stayed with these two friends in their house in Auckland for 2 years. Life in Auckland was crazy. It was a new way of life with terrible weather. It was hard to cope. Culture shock is a big thing that affects all immigrants, and I was no exception. Although I was lucky to be able to speak English, I had to pay extra attention when listening because people here speak very fast. Searching for a job is the main headache for newly arrived immigrants. I was a certified nurse back home, but I was told that my existing knowledge and skills wouldn't matter here, especially if I'd never worked in the field in New Zealand in the last 5 years. My nursing diploma was of no use unless I upgraded it. So I enrolled for a course and found a job in a supermarket. Through my supermarket job, I earned some money. Finally, after years on the run, I was able to support my wife, whom I'd left in Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia. I started a process of bringing my family to New Zealand through the family sponsorship program. In 2002, my family joined me in Auckland. I was very happy. I talked to Housing New Zealand again and asked them about accommodation. Surprisingly, they acted differently this time. They provided my family with a house and we stayed together as a family once again after 9 painful years apart. I'm currently a self-employed city taxi driver. Taxi driving is good and terrible at the same time. It's good in a way that you're your own boss, but it's terrible in a sense that you can get robbed and the police wouldn't respond to your calls as urgently as possible. Sometimes a passenger wouldn't pay me because of my race, and even when I've reported an incident, no actions have been taken. There's not much protection for people of colour in the taxi business. One time, a drunken passenger vomited in my taxi but refused to clean it when I asked him to. I called the police, but when you don't talk like a Kiwi, they don't respond to your call quickly. And there's a lot of racism in the taxi business, but that doesn't override my love for New Zealand. One good thing about New Zealand is that it provides a lot of democratic spaces. You can breathe out your frustration until your lungs are exhausted. In Africa, police are viewed as an enemy of the communities, but in New Zealand, police are the best friends of the communities. The healthcare system here is superb. Most people are very polite, although you encounter some rude people like in Housing New Zealand. But people help you when you're in dire need. One time, my expectant wife went into labour and called an ambulance. While she was hurrying to the hospital, she gave birth on the motorway. She got all the help she needed along the way. There are no such services in Ethiopia, Eritrea, or Sudan. New Zealand is my home and my kids have a future here and they know it. I'll take this opportunity to thank Eritrea and Sudan for their hospitality and thank the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees for the care. And for those who want to immigrate to New Zealand, I'll say that this is a great country to live, but you have to come with a clear goal and program. As long as you respect the law, respect other people and know what you're doing, you'll be good. Some people start messing up on arrival because they don't know what they're looking for in life once they get to New Zealand. They expect everything here to be a bed of roses. Francesca Marciano couldn't have put it better when he said, "When you leave Africa, as the plane lifts, you feel that more than leaving a continent, you're leaving a state of mind. Whatever awaits you at the other end of your journey will be of a different order of existence. So be prepared."
Originally, I came to New Zealand from Sudan on the 20th of July, 2012. I had lived in a refugee camp in Chad for 8 years. I went there with my husband and 5 kids, 2 girls and 3 boys. After 6 years in the refugee camp, my husband passed away. After my husband's sudden death, my daughter and I became very ill. The 2 years following my husband's passing proved to be a very difficult time for me. And this is what led us to being referred to New Zealand as an emergency case for treatment. First, the good thing about New Zealand is the way the government treated us regarding our health problems. Secondly, the simple life provides us with hope to feel our happiness and live with our family together. What worries me in terms of challenges contributing to my life in New Zealand is first of all the language problem. I came to New Zealand without knowing any other people, and this provided a real challenge. I speak Arabic, so they bring Iraqi people to translate for me, but the dialect of Iraqi people and my accent do not match. Then there are letters from government agencies. For example, Work and Income New Zealand, WINS. Sometimes letters were sent by WINS requesting me to come to an appointment. But no one was able to read that letter for me and tell me the details. So my appointment would pass and my support would be cut. When I was able to go there, they would not back pay me for the payment period I missed. This made things very difficult because I am the sole person responsible for payments and I'm not working. I cannot get my head around how the health system works either. For example, my daughter was supposed to have an operation on her teeth, but she missed it because of language difficulties and misunderstandings. Being the only person who speaks my language in New Zealand has affected my life greatly. Sometimes there were things happening at my children's school, but I would be unable to come through for them. If they get bullied at school because they look different and they come home and complain about it, I don't have the ability to go and explain what my children are feeling to the school staff. I can't help them with their schoolwork at home either. Sometimes there is a family conference at the school. Since I will not be able to go there and listen to my children's reports, often my children will report themselves. I don't know what to do about it. Everything is stopping me from progressing. But in general, I'm fine and learning to cope with things. I really don't have enough knowledge to say what should be put in place to help me. In my specific case, it would help to have someone who could translate for me. If there was some kind of transitioning system or schooling for parents to make sure they understand what the system of education looks like, that would be great. There are times when my children translate for me, but I have doubts and my heart tells me that what has been relayed is not the complete picture of what has been said. It makes me feel very upset and powerless. I often think that if only there were some kind of proper transition for people on my level, because I guess you can place me as a high-needs person in terms of language and in terms of navigating the system. I've never been to school, but this should not stop me from being part of the society I need to be part of. If there was more help in terms of language, this is the most important thing that would make life better for me. Back home, I was amongst my extended family. Everyone was there during Eid al-Adha or other celebrations. I used to go and create an income to support my family. If you have money, you will be able to put your children in school. So comparatively with New Zealand, there is a difference. I acknowledge the government for giving me a house, for giving me benefit, and for my children going to school. But I remain in isolation. Back home, I stayed with extended family, where I could see love and happiness in all the social gatherings. Here in New Zealand, I get things that I didn't have back home, and what I had back home, I cannot find here. I hope that things will get better, and I will be able to drive to grocery stores and make bill payments on time. It is the basic stuff that matters, but these things are proving to be real challenges. I only pray that the future will be good for my children. I would like my daughter to get married and stay with us, and that our family will grow, and that my other children can go to school and achieve something good. I am hoping for my kids' future to be filled with beautiful things that I have never had in my life. For my older son, Izzedine, I hope he will finish school and go to university, graduate and find a job, and afterwards to go and get married back home and bring his new wife here. The education for my children is what I value most, so if they could go through university, get qualifications and find meaningful jobs, I won't have any other problems. I need to make sure that my grandchildren come from united families. Most importantly, they need to contribute to New Zealand as a country, because this is the country that offers a fair shot in life. I value New Zealand's contribution to my family, and in return, future generations need to contribute back to New Zealand society. I love New Zealand more than any other country. One of the best things I love about New Zealand is freedom of speech. Here you can talk without fear of punishment. Everyone has security guarantees. People are protected by law, irrespective of religion, gender, or age. Sometimes I remember bad things that happened in my life, and those are the times when I get scared. But I know I am safe here.
We can ask New Zealand to look at its funding for humanitarian programs to UNHCR or other UN agencies. We can ask New Zealand to look at increasing the number of resettlement places it allocates to Syrian refugees. New Zealand has responded to our call to do that. It's allocated. It said it will take 100 Syrian refugees from the major refugee hosting countries in the region, and that's on top of its normal quota. So that's a great start. If New Zealand wanted to increase that, of course, we'd be very pleased.
I am from Myanmar. Myanmar is located in Southeast Asia, formerly known as Burma. Myanmar is bordered by India, Bangladesh, China, Laos, and Thailand. Yangon is the nation's capital. The Myanmar education system is dominated by the Burmese language. English is learned only as a subject in the schools. After completing high school, I obtained a Bachelor of Social Science degree through distance learning, but I couldn't communicate in English. My social science degree led me to my first job, a clerk in Mai Chinai Court. The salary of a clerk was a mismatch for Myanmar's markets. far below US $50 per month. Because I couldn't live within my means as a clerk's job, I resigned. I got a managerial job in 1999. I was employed as a sector manager in Upcountry's construction company, based in Yangon. The managerial job didn't take away the financial burden that I had, but it outweighed the earnings from my previous job. The culture of the governing system in Myanmar criminalized fleeing the country as refugees. Relatives of the person who had fled are always subjected to punishment, especially if you just happen to be a government employee. My brother's refugee status in Malaysia affected us, as his relatives still live in Myanmar. There were times I would be called by authorities to record statements, giving them the assurances that I will not run away like my brother. They didn't stop there. They also monitored my movements, even scrutinized my trips between Yangon and the villages. There are no moral grounds for one to be punished because of a relative's wrongdoing. While in Malaysia, my brother was sponsored by the United Nations to move to New Zealand permanently. When my brother informed me that he could sponsor my wife and me to come and live with him in New Zealand, I was excited. I felt that a second chance had come to live a life free of dictatorship. Since my brother lived alone in New Zealand, he was allowed to sponsor a close relative under the refugee family support category. This is allowed in order to avoid stress caused by loneliness. In 2011, my wife and I came to New Zealand under my brother's refugee family support category sponsorship. We didn't go to Mangaree Refugee Resettlement Centre for accommodation because we were not refugees. A dream of a second chance to live a decent life and of making my own decisions without anybody's interference had materialised. Auckland is good, but not the best for a new arrival who doesn't speak English. The struggle to get a job was traumatizing to me. Employers turned me down because of a breakdown in communication. All Work and Income New Zealand wanted to know is why I didn't have a job, but they were not concerned with the reasons behind not having a job. Sometimes Work and Income New Zealand doesn't consider how one's lack of English language is a blockade to employment. After enrolling to study basic English and further four foundations in 2012, my English improved and I got a job as a machine operator at New Zealand Health Manufacturing, a company that produces capsule medicines. Things began to pick up. When I completed a certificate in social services and a diploma in English language, the language barriers that blocked my way to employment disappeared. I managed to find job after job because my English could be understood and I was now capable of understanding employers. I learned several new techniques for job searching. I am currently a full-time student working towards a Bachelor of Social Work degree in Auckland. It is utterly sad when one comes to this great nation and they face discrimination instantly. The truth is that there is a lot of unfair treatment of people of colour in Work and Income New Zealand, as well as StudyLink and Housing New Zealand. Discrimination in such branches is done openly and with no disciplinary measures taken against the employees who entertain the practice. I walked into Work and Income New Zealand one time to apply for a house because it was time to get a place of my own. This woman who worked there dramatized my case by yelling at me in public, saying, "Don't you have a culture in Myanmar? How come a brother can kick you out? Blah, blah, blah." She couldn't stop shouting at the top of her lungs. Even though I told her the real situation was that my brother was not kicking me out, he had gotten married and they were expecting a baby soon. I was embarrassed. I was asking her to cool down her temper and talk to me as an adult. but she continued to yell at me in front of everybody. Still, life has been good since I came to New Zealand. When I came, I couldn't speak English, but now I am working towards a bachelor's degree in social work practice. Nothing is more amazing, and I am appreciative that New Zealand has given me a second chance to rebuild my life. I am enjoying lots of privileges that nobody could provide for me in Myanmar. New Zealand is my home. I am a community person. I am one of the founders of the Auckland Zomi Inkuan community, started 2 years ago, and we now have a well-structured Zomi Inkuan community in Auckland. I want to be a professional social worker and help communities. I don't want people to suffer the way I did when I first came here. If you are a new arrival to New Zealand, make sure you enroll in English classes and improve your English skills to obtain your goals. English is essential here to quickly adapt to New Zealand's multicultural environment. Nothing is ready and waiting for you. You have to be prepared and work hard to achieve your goals. Never miss a second chance in life. One can get financial help from the government, but it's more stressful being dependent. Get on your feet and be on your own.
Originally from the Republic of South Sudan, which separated from Sudan on July 9, 2011, after I had already resettled in New Zealand as a new settler. 21 years of the deadliest civil wars on the African continent occurred from 1983 to 2005, resulting in Sudan split into two independent countries. Millions of people died. Tragically, South Sudan entered its own civil war 2 years after it gained its independence from Sudan, and this war is still ongoing. Only God knows when the fighting will stop. South Sudan is rich in oil, minerals, and other natural resources, but poor in infrastructure. People only know and hear about the war side of South Sudan, not its beauty and natural resources. I am the eldest son in a family of 5 boys and 3 girls. My father was a well-known builder in our area. My mother was a housewife, but both of them were also farmers. Panyidwe Paju, our village where I grew up, is not far from Malakal, capital of the Upper Nile State. I always traveled between Panyidwe Paju and Malakal. My father was a traditional Sholok, who held very strong Sholok values, norms, and beliefs. Sholok is one of South Sudan's 64 tribes. We, the Sholok people, live along the west and east bank of the White River Nile and Sabat River. We have been ruled by a divine king for centuries. We hold strong customs. Our Sholok king, which we call Ref, is the head of the tribe. Although the Sholok are settled communities along the River Nile, we are pastoralists. We keep herds of cattle, sheep, and goats, but largely invest in subsistence farming. My family owned 1,000 hectares of land with cows, goats, and sheep. The community viewed my father as a rich man and treated him with high regard. I lived in Malakal for school purposes and would only come to Panyidwe Paju, our village, during the school holidays. I was responsible for my books in Malakal, but I immediately assumed the responsibility of our livestock when I was in Panyidwe Paju. I grazed cows, goats, and sheep for several hours in the open fields of Savannah grasslands, while making sure that the naughty calves didn't stray from their mothers. I would keep my eyes open for any wild animal that may attack them. With my traditional spears, I had to face any lion that may attempt to attack the cows. If I lost one to any wild animal, I would be severely punished. This is where my responsibility started as a young boy. Life was simple, but happy. Life turned ugly in 1983 when the Second Sudanese Civil War broke out between the government forces and South Sudanese armed rebels known as Sudan's People's Liberation Movement. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement was fighting for an independent South Sudan, but the government in Khartoum was determined not to allow Sudan to break up into two countries. The Sudanese government sent its military combat forces to Malakal to fight Sudan People's Liberation Movement and turned all schools into military barracks. On the other side of the river, which is adjacent to Malakal, was home to armed rebels. All the Shilluk villages were made into military barracks by combative forces. We became displaced people in our own homes. No school, no farming, and no animal grazing. The insecurity was on the rise. Sudan went through two civil wars. The first Sudanese civil war was fought in 1955 to 1975, and the second was fought from 1983 to 2005. These wars caused the loss of more than 3.5 million lives and many millions of displaced people. One life lost during the Civil War included my grandfather, Ajako, who was killed in 1971. My father was killed in the Second Civil War in 1989. The wars took a huge toll on our family. As a result of two opposing military forces occupying entire communities, South Sudan was not safe anymore. The government of Sudan and rebels were fighting in our land, the Shilluk land, and the results were devastating. Civilians were killed indiscriminately. Women were raped. Even girls as young as 9 years of age were not spared. The rebels were carrying out a massive recruitment of young people against their will. The warring armies committed atrocities. In this political atmosphere, my father believed that there was no future for me in Malakal. He didn't want me to be conscripted into the army of any side. One day, my father told me, "Son, I have gone through the first South Sudanese civil war in my life and believe the answer for all these military conflicts in South Sudan is education. I want you to go to Sudan, where it is more peaceful, and stay with my brother." Moving to North Sudan at the age of 13 meant vulnerability, and although I would be an internally displaced person there, life would be better in Khartoum than it would have been in Malakal. I went to Northern Sudan with my young brother, William, and my maternal grandmother. We settled in Haj Abdullah and lived there for 9 years as a displaced minor. I started my education there, but it was difficult to cope with the different cultures in one country. Schools in North Sudan used Arabic as a language of instruction. There had been more English classes and less Arabic in Malakal, so I had to learn more Arabic. Education in Sudan was more about achievement, with a high level of competition among classmates in the Sudan education system. It took me a few years to improve my Arabic language so that I could pass my classes with good grades. While in school, I also worked in a restaurant. The money I got supported my younger brother and me. I saved some money and started a small business. My father had taught me how to fix doors and windows in residential houses, so I was making money in a construction business while teaching part-time as well. The year of 1989 was not a good year for me. I received bad news about my father. He had been killed by Nuer tribe militia who occupied our district at Dolib Hill. They had killed other relatives as well. I felt so shocked to hear the tragic news. As I was going through the grieving process, I remembered his words of encouragement. He used to advise me to take school seriously as it will be my future. He wanted me to go to university, so I decided to put education first in my life. A big part of his legacy was the value he placed on education. And as the eldest son in my family, I thought getting an education was the best way to respect my father. I still believe that education is everything in my life, and that through education, I could live my father's dream, not only in school, but also in my daily life. The system in northern Sudan treats South Sudanese people badly for being Christians. There has not been freedom of religion since Sudan was turned into an Islamic state in 1985. In North Sudan, you have to be a Muslim to receive equal treatment. If you are South Sudanese, you will be treated as a second-class citizen. On August 3, 2000, I went to Syria. I was pursuing educational opportunities while trying to find job opportunities as well. I was lucky to get a few construction jobs to support my siblings and my mother back in Sudan. As I got used to Syrian culture, I got a good job. I was employed as an assistant manager at Khalil Al-Daya Oriental Shop in Syria. It was a big shop, and I worked 7 days a week, except for 3 hours I used for church service on Sundays. I worked my bones off to maintain myself. Through this job, I was able to pay my bills. Life improved a bit. With the little money I made, I was stepping into my father's shoes. As the firstborn in the family, I needed to fulfill my role. I must take care of my whole family. In 2001, I was nearly deported back to Sudan against my will by the Syrian authorities. The Sudanese government didn't want any South Sudanese to stay in Syria on the grounds that the South Sudanese people may sabotage the government in Khartoum. The Sudanese government ordered, through its bilateral relations with Syria, to deport all South Sudanese who lived in Syria without a stay visa, whether they were under the protection of the United Nations or not. That was a huge number to deport. All South Sudanese protested against the decision and urged the United Nations to protect the refugees. We were all rounded up and crammed into Syrian military barracks awaiting deportation. Everyone was a prisoner. I stayed in the Syrian prison for 3 months and 10 days under inhumane treatment. It took me 5 years to get refugee status under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees local office in Damascus. The process to claim protection under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Syria was a long one. Patience and perseverance were the guiding principles that kept my head up. In 2005, 5 months after getting refugee status, I was asked to resettle in New Zealand. This came as an emergency case. I felt so happy about this decision because this would also mean that I would be able to receive further education in New Zealand and find employment opportunities. I finally had hope that this could be the beginning of a better life for me and my family. In 2005, I arrived in Auckland, New Zealand. I came with my 2 daughters and my lovely wife, Mary. We stayed in Mangere Refugee Resettlement Center for 6 weeks, after which time we also received an orientation program organized by the New Zealand government. When I moved into the community, I realized that things were not going to be as easy as I thought. I was faced with the reality of resettlement challenges. It was very hard to understand and navigate basic resettlement issues such as neighborhood connections, networking, and access to available services. Fortunately, there were some levels of government support from refugee services and social workers to deal with some of these challenges. For the first 6 months, Jeff and Nikki Mando were our first New Zealand family contacts from the Refugee Service Volunteers Program, and my family and I were lucky to have them. The place that made me love New Zealand was Mangere Bridge Mountain. I used to go to this mountaintop every day, enjoying the view of Auckland. I loved it because it gave me a sense of belonging, and I knew that I wanted to stay in New Zealand. I needed to find employment as soon as possible to comply with the work and income New Zealand policy. I felt a lot of pressure from them to find a job. One day, a staff member told me, "You need to find a job." However, getting employed was a problem. All of the potential employers asked me 3 questions. Do you have New Zealand qualifications? Do you have New Zealand work experience? Do you have a professional network in New Zealand?
And I thought to myself that these people must be joking. How do I get these things? Can anyone get New Zealand qualifications, work experience, or connect to New Zealand professional networks in a matter of months as a new arrival? Obviously, the answer was no. I have just arrived in the country. From that time, I started to challenge myself. I was determined to improve my situation. Some questions stuck in my mind, though. Why was there no job seekers support system in place to help newcomers find jobs? In 2005, I enrolled in a language and literacy skills program at Tamaki Kiraro Training. I also took free computer courses at Māngere Town Centre. After completing these courses, I enrolled in an employment skill English course at Manukau Institute of Technology. Even though I could speak English, I also wanted to learn everyday conversational English. I couldn't speak with a Kiwi accent, and I knew I needed to speak better English. One time in our class, the English teacher gave me a newspaper. I really tried my best to find a job, but I was never called for a job interview, whether I applied online or in person. Later on, I found out that the New Zealand employers didn't hire me, not because I didn't have the skills for jobs, but because my name was different. The fact that I didn't have a professional network in New Zealand and a lack of New Zealand work experience added to my burden of trying to find a job. After finishing the employment skilled English course, I planned to start my own business, so I enrolled in automotive engineering courses. I worked very hard and completed levels 2, 3, and 4 in automotive engineering. While I was studying the automotive engineering courses, I also enrolled for a national certificate in computing levels 2, 3, and 4 at Te Wānanga o Aotearoa, which also included a national certificate in first-line management and leadership. Between semesters, there were holiday breaks. During these holidays, I did not receive any student allowance, so I had to go back to Work and Income New Zealand and ask for financial support. I then found out that I was eligible to apply for student hardship benefits during the holiday period. Working in different mechanical workshops for 2 years as part of my school study was the first New Zealand work experience I got. And because work experience is not always paid work, the Work and Income Department wasn't convinced I needed support. I was wondering why there weren't any agencies available to new immigrants to help them with the skills they needed on arrival to ensure they could enter the workforce straight away. Many people come with skills. It's just a matter of upgrading to match their skills to New Zealand standards. People learn on the job. Just give them a chance.
Show for this week.
Take care until next Saturday, same time, 10 to 5 on Planet FM 104.6
and on the web. www.plantaudio.org.nz/resetterradio.